Welcome to a new episode of Academia Insights. In the horse world, we are very good at talking about muscles, joints, posture, and maybe also training techniques. But we are surprisingly bad at talking about the system that actually runs all of it, and that is the nervous system. Most chronic tensions, crookedness, unexplained pain, training plateaus, and even behavioral changes are still discussed as if they were primarily structural problems. But in reality, a large part of what we observe in horses is not or not only a tissue problem, it's often also a learning problem about the nervous system. And that is what we are talking about today. We are diving into a field that sits at the intersection of neuroscience, motor learning, and pain science and movement education. Today, we will talk about hanosomatics and its application to horses, which is also known as equine hanosomatics. This approach is built on a simple but very powerful idea, and I hope I'm not telling anything wrong, because otherwise Alyssa needs to correct me later. So the idea is very powerful, that many chronic muscular and postural patterns are not the result of damage, but of learned automatic tension patterns in the brain and in the nervous system. And that these patterns can be retrained through sensory motor learning. That's the idea that is fitting also perfectly into our Equidemia philosophy, understanding the horse before correcting it and looking for causes instead of managing symptoms. My guest today is Alyssa Meyer, one of the leading voices in the field of equine hanosomatics. She works at the interface of somatic education, neuroscience, and horse training, helping horses and humans to relearn how to move with more ease, stability, and self-regulation. Welcome, Alyssa.
Thank you so much, Selena. That was a beautiful introduction. And it sounds like you get it, which I love.
I hope so. I was trying to do my homework and dig a little bit deeper here. And I have a background in body work, but very sadly, I have not a lot of knowledge about hanosomatics. And I hope that will change with today. I have a few of my students actually are taking your course and are taking your education. And I was very excited by the results that they got. So I got a bit curious, and I had to invite you today for learning more about your work.
Well, I'm so happy to be here, and I've been following your work for a couple of years as well and been aware of what you're doing and loving it. So I'm really happy to be here and to share this stuff that I do, because it's just, everybody needs to know this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. So before we are going deeper into techniques, I want to place this conversation also a little bit where it belongs, because at Equidemia, we are often working with horses that are labeled as tight or stiff or difficult in training. And most often when we are going into gait analysis what's actually happening, we realize we are not dealing with an isolated issue or even tissue. We are dealing with a complex and complete horse that maybe has a lot of stress, that maybe has learned something, maybe also the environment. I've just recently learned that also in English you're saying Umwelt is maybe not so perfect as we want it to be. And I mean, whenever is life perfect? Doesn't happen to me so often. And that is where you are and your work is also coming into the picture. So when we are talking about hanosomatics, what is the core problem, or what is the core of this system that it is trying to address?
That is the question.
I know.
Yeah. No, I feel like ever since I learned about this work, which I think was 2010 or 2009, maybe, when I first came across hanosomatics and how it was used with horses first, I've been trying to come up with the elevator pitch to give a simple, short, sweet, easy to understand answer to that question. And I feel like, however many years later, almost 15 years later, I'm still working on that, but I will give it my best shot. And that is that Hannah Somatics is distinct from the category most people think it falls under, which is body work or kind of a clinical therapeutic type of work. It has the effects of those type of works, but it is somatic education, meaning it is something that you do with yourself, for yourself, to change yourself. So the word soma, it's a Greek word. It's been around for a long time, but it was redefined as the body as experienced from within. So you are a soma. I am a soma. The horse, each horse is a soma. And each of us is having a unique experience of living inside our body, experiencing the world through our senses, and moving through life in the body that we're born into. So each of us, we have language, whichever language it is, to try to discuss what it feels like to be a soma and be alive. But we don't always choose the same words or connect. And so we're assuming we're all having a pretty similar experience, depending on what species we are, I suppose. But so that's the work. It's first of all, recognizing that we are each individual somas having an individual experience of living life as a being on the planet, and also recognizing that the mind and the body are not actually separate the way most of the time we talk about them, as if they are separate. And I think it's because language has given us the ability to label the mind and the body and all of our various parts as separate so that we can talk about them, that we tend to think of them as separate. And ever since that first happened, probably at the beginning of the first language that developed, we've been coming up with ways to try to get the mind and the body back together. And that's what I feel like most of the practices, treatments, therapies, self-development, educate, like almost everything that we do in some way is related to getting the mind and the body to integrate or to be back together. And I don't think they were ever separate. And if we can recognize that the mind and the body are not separate, have never been separate, it's one thing. And now the trend is to call it the nervous system, which is definitely a thing that we all have and that is operating inside all of us and doing things that we can't even begin to explain. It's so complex. But that Hannah Somatics is a way of working within your soma, within your nervous system, to enhance our inherent ability to self-regulate, to be healthy, to have great body awareness, and to be functional. And the main dysfunction that was identified and named by Thomas Hanna back in the 1980s, or probably even in the 70s before he started publishing his work, is motor sensory amnesia, or he called it sensory motor amnesia. Now we call it motor sensory amnesia. And that is the tendency to learn and get stuck into patterns as we respond to life, and then to forget how it used to be before we did that. So we are constantly living in a state of our new normal. Where we're at right now is our normal default place that has been accumulating for our whole life. And we tend to forget, which is where the term amnesia comes from. We forget what it felt like before we came off that horse, or before we were in that car accident, or before we grew up, and what it felt like to be a kid who bounced instead of broke when you hit the ground, or you could fill in the blank with any experience. But we forget, and this is a function of our nervous system and of our brain to allow us to continue to move forward in life. We forget what normal used to feel like. We just live in the now. And unfortunately, that leads us to accumulate these adaptive responses to stress, and they build up in our body, and eventually they present as tension or distorted posture, which then there's a whole bunch of other symptoms and diseases that can be traced back to that accumulation of chronic tension that we don't even know we're doing. And that most treatments and approaches and drugs and medications and therapies don't influence for very long, because they are something that we learned and that we're actively doing. They're not something that's in our muscle. It's not, you know, a thickening of the fascia. It's not anything really that you can isolate in the body. It's what we're actually doing with our body in that moment that we are doing as an unconscious habit. And Hannah Somatics is a way to get our own internal nervous system to recognize that we have an adaptation that is no longer serving us and reset it back to normal. Because we're meant to do that. We're built to do that. But we typically don't do that as quickly as we are stressed in modern times. Same thing with domestic horses. We're experiencing stress and we're responding to stress and habituating to our responses. I can see my shoulders doing it in the video right now. Mm-hmm. we repeat that and we habituate to it constantly, and we're not naturally equipped to counterbalance that with our natural mechanisms and our natural self-regulation in our modern day.
In our modern days. And that is for humans or for me. I can recognize that a lot when I'm having many days with office work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The sitting on a desk is, you know, the shoulders come up and you're sitting here with your mouse arm. Yeah. And I believe it's the same for our horses, especially if they only have narrow turnouts. They always do the same turns the whole day long.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was a game. Yeah, repetition. And for me, it was a game changer when I moved out to Norway here and rewilded my dressage horses and put them out on the mountains and let them. In summer, they are outside the fence and now allowed to run free. And their whole body changed. They got a level of elasticity and smoothness and fitness that was completely impossible to train. Just by having the possibility to use their body in a more natural way and to respond to their environment. Amazing.
What lucky horses.
Yeah. It's also, you know, now I'm always saying that before I moved here, we had our bonding time in the riding arena. And then this was the most important time of the day because they had not so much other stuff to do. Even if we were trying hard to do it as good as we can. But now it's the opposite way around. Now they have a life, they are free, they can live in the mountains. And I am allowed to come as a kind of entertainer in. And then we can do a little bit of massage or a little bit of trick training or a little bit of shoulder in. And it's a quite nice entertainment, but not substantial anymore. It's just a change of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So the way you're talking about the body is very much resonating with me and very much resonating also with this experience of rewilding the horses and giving their access capacity to have control over their body, and with that also over their mind, because that was also a huge shift that I experienced where I thought, okay, here's something really big happening. I see the body changing, but I also see the mind changing. And I believe that is something that you experience in your work from day to day, right?
Absolutely. And on all of the levels that can happen. So learning at its most fundamental level should and usually involves movement of some sort, because horses and humans, all animals, are kinetic beings. And if we're put in a situation where we're not able to move and we're not receiving a lot of sensory feedback about our environment or from our body because we're not moving enough, that slows down the learning process. So horses who live in stables, people who sit all day. So after this, you and I are going to get up and go for a walk and go play with our horses. it's a type of sensory deprivation to not move.
Yeah,
and that stunts development, cognitive development, and physical development. So many horses who live in confinement are actually younger than their years, right? Their brains and their nervous system have not developed as far as they would if they were living how your horses are now, or out in nature, where they are from the moment they're born and hit the ground, they are engaging with their environment kind of to the maximum capability. And so they learn and develop and build neural connections and networks and experiences and memories that they can draw upon to make decisions and to move forward efficiently from that moment. And so I see that in my work with horses, is that you'll meet horses who appear very young in their way they interact with the world, or inexperienced, even if they've been around for years. And then we see that change really rapidly when you change their environment or when they start doing equine hand of somatics. And this whole approach of hand of somatics is through movement. So that's the way that we are engaging with the nervous system, is by asking the horse or the person or ourselves, depending on who is the client in the moment, to move. And from that movement, we generate feedback for ourselves, sensory feedback to learn from. And based on what we learn or what we feel, we then move again. And then we can compare the outcome of what we thought we were going to do versus what we actually did and what it felt like to move. And then we can improve it or adjust it and make changes to it. So we are doing this work, engaging in natural movements, kind of from the opposite end of the motor sensory spectrum than how most people are doing things, trying to help the body, which would be through sensory input. And that's why a few years ago, Eleanor Criswell, who was my teacher and mentor, and who actually took the human Hanna somatics work that she and her husband, Thomas Hanna, had co-developed and applied it to working with horses. Mm. I really totally lost it when I said that.
Translation to horses? Oh, maybe it comes back later.
I got it. A couple of years ago, she and kind of the governing body and people who are in the heart of the Hanna somatics education world reframed sensory motor amnesia to motor sensory amnesia. Because when we're working with an individual with Hanna somatics, we're working with the motor output first, and the sensory output is secondary and comes along with it. So you're always working with motor and sensory because they're two halves of a whole. They're two sides of a continuous loop of action and feedback that's happening inside the nervous system. Mm. But you can enter that loop in various places.
And that is where it's getting very interesting, I think, because I can imagine how that works with humans, as we can simply communicate also through words and also by showing something and asking the other person to maybe imitate or repeat. But how can we translate that into the equine context?
Well, I have been told that sometimes I get a little too heavy on like the neuroscience jargon when I'm explaining this stuff.
No,
so I'm going to try not to.
You are allowed to. In this here, you are allowed to. We always send out references with the podcast.
Excellent. Okay. But so understanding at least some of the basic neurophysiology or the neuroscience behind this work helps me to answer that question for you and for everyone who's listening, because Hanna somatics really is based in the fundamental principles of neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a natural reflex that all animals do, which is called pandiculation. Mm-hmm. You might already know what pandiculation is. 10 years ago when I said that, people gave me that like totally blank stare, like, what is that? But pandiculation is what we do when we wake up and we kind of do this like, oh, it feels so good, stretch in the morning. Or it's what our cats and dogs and horses do when they wake up after sleeping. Foals do it in their mother's womb. Babies do it in their mother's womb. And animals tend to do it a lot when they're young and then less and less as they age. Mm-hmm. They tend to not pandiculate when they're ill or lame or injured. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully they start doing it again. But it's this really fantastic natural reflex that prepares the body to move after periods of not moving, mm-hmm. which often includes muscles being in shortened or asymmetrical positions because we've been sitting hunched over our laptop or curled in a ball, sleeping by the fireplace if you're a lucky animal who lives in a home. Or standing still in a stable or taking a nap under a tree if you're a lucky horse, right? So that reflex is really the basis of all of the movements that we're doing in Hanna somatic education. So because it's a natural movement that horses do anyway and that people do anyway, if we can communicate to them what we want them to do, we can get them to participate in the work. But that's the key. They have to do the work. They have to participate. A horse cannot receive Hanna somatics. Mm-hmm. A person can't receive the work the way you can receive a massage or receive body work or acupuncture or medicine or, you know, because it's the act of doing the movement that causes the changes inside the nervous system, that causes a shift in the level of brain control over the movement, that is what gives us the outcome of reducing the chronic tension. So how do you get a horse to do that? Well, with people,
exactly,
I have to start with, right? So with people, there's two ways that we do hanasomatics. One is verbally guiding. So I can explain to you what to do with your own body, right? I can tell you that if you turn your head to the right, tilt your head back and lift your left shoulder, you've contracted your upper trapezius muscle. And then I could invite you to very slowly bring your left shoulder down as you bring your head back to a neutral position. And if you do it slowly enough, now you're voluntarily decontracting your trapezius muscle. And if you do that correctly, you'll be doing a voluntary pendiculation rather than a spontaneous one, which I might do the same movement in the morning when I'm stretching. We call it stretching, but it's not stretching. When I'm pendiculating as a reflex spontaneously, but you can do the exact same movements with intention voluntarily and get the same beneficial results. Mm-hmm. The other way we do hanasomatics with people is you can work with a trained hanasomatic educator, a trained professional who can be there with you. And if you can't figure out, because you have motor sensory amnesia, you can't feel where your shoulder is and you don't know if you've lifted it or not, they can use some hands-on techniques to help you find how to do that movement, but they'll still have you do it with your own body, right? So we can do verbally guided somatic movement classes where I could do a session with you or we could do a group. We do this with equestrians a lot. Mm-hmm. Or you can work one-on-one with a practitioner. Mm-hmm. Horses don't generally sign up to do Zoom classes. So usually we have to be either one-on-one with them in person or we can talk the horse owner through doing this work with them. And you have to communicate non-verbally what you want the horse to do. So we start with asking them to pick up their feet, right? But we don't just want them to pick it up and put it down the way they usually do, because that would be not with intention. That would be an automatic pattern or a conditioned response that would not get them to send motor output from the right part of their brain. We need them to understand what we're asking and then do it with us at the speed we invite them to, in order for it to be a voluntary pendiculation and not just a regular automatic movement. So you can do it kind of any way that you can communicate that. So I can explain or teach you how I do it, how I get a horse to understand what I'm asking them to do. And this is where horsemanship and animal communication and just being feel and being good with horses comes in, right? Any way that you can get the horse to understand, I'd like you to pick up your left front foot, but not too high, because I don't want you to stretch it. I don't want you to push through pain. I don't want you to brace. I don't want you to, you know, go beyond your comfortable range of motion. And now I want you to very slowly, with intention, bring your foot back to the ground and then put your weight on it. So you might ask a horse or communicate that to a horse a little bit differently than I would. And then you might have to do it a little bit differently for your other horse. Or if I came there or you came here, the horses speak a little bit of a different language or have a different dialect, but they still basically speak body language and can understand energy. And maybe they can even pick up what we're thinking telepathically. I think pretty soon we'll be able to prove that, but we don't have studies there yet. But that's basically how you do it with the horse. And then the more you know what you're asking them to do and the better you are at communicating with the horse and getting them on board, the more muscles and muscle groups you can get them to voluntarily pendiculate in an equine hanasomatic session. That's how we do it with horses.
Sounds very easy if you're describing it like this.
It isn't always easy, but it is fairly simple. What we're, you know, like what we're trying to do is pretty straightforward. We want a horse to do a voluntary pendiculation movement. Right. In order for it to be a voluntary pendiculation, and this is where we can dive into neuroscience a little bit, we need them to use the voluntary motor cortex part of their brain. Right. That's the part of your brain you use when you're learning something for the first time. It's the part that babies or young animals use when they're learning how to walk, when they're like, if we're learning dance choreography, or the first time we get on a horse and we throw our leg over, we might not have ever done that before. So you really have to think about how to do it, how to organize your body, how to shift your weight, how high to lift your leg. So you're using the voluntary motor cortex to send motor output to the appropriate muscles and areas of your body. Hopefully they coordinate automatically, but they don't always at first. And that's where the learning comes in, because if you don't lift your leg high enough, your knee will hit the saddle. You'll get pain, sensory feedback, and then the next time you'll lift your leg higher. That's how the motor learning works. So we need them to send that motor output from the voluntary motor cortex during both the concentric and the eccentric phases of muscle contraction. Now, if anyone listening to this is not a muscle nerd, that means both when the muscle is shortening and contracting to do the movement, so the active phase is what we usually think of that, but also during the slow coming out of whatever the movement was. So as the muscle is lengthening, that's the eccentric contraction. We have to be engaged with both the doing and the undoing with the voluntary motor cortex for it to be a voluntary pandiculation. And the outcome of that is that the habitual state of that muscle gets reset back to a normal neutral state, which is usually less active, less contracted, meaning it's more relaxed, softer, more in a healthy state of neutral instead of a chronically contracted state.
Sounds very beautiful. And as you are a muscle nerd and I am a muscle nerd, but we are trying to take along also all our listeners who aren't and who sometimes then in a different language have a little bit difficulties to follow. Please explain the difference in between the voluntary contraction and the opposite of it, and simple stretching, because it's not the same. And I think it's very important to make this distinction that you get a different effect if a horse is voluntarily participating or if you're pulling on a leg.
Mm-hmm. Very different. Very different. Let's see, where should we start? So most of the time when we're moving or when a horse is moving around, we're moving on, I'm going to call it autopilot, right? As we're talking here, you're nodding when I you agree with something I say, you're resting your hand on your chin and moving your head around. We gesture with our hands. We're not really doing that on purpose or with much awareness or intention. We're just doing it because we're doing it, right? It's probably something we've done before. It's probably something we do all the time. And it's operating on autopilot, which means the motor output, right? So motor output are the electrochemical impulses that travel from the brain down the spinal cord, exit at segments of the spinal cord, and then travel through the nerves to particular areas of the body. And then they activate your muscles to do something. Muscles are pretty straightforward. They either shorten or they lengthen, right? So that's what motor output is. It's the signals coming from the brain or the spinal cord, from the central nervous system, that tell muscles what to do. That motor output for most of the moving that we do comes from the midbrain or the brainstem, or sometimes it'll come directly from the spinal cord if we're responding to a reflex. The voluntary motor cortex, it's just a different part of the brain. It's on humans, on horses too. It's right up, if we were wearing a headband, it's right close to the surface in the brain. So it's the part that we use when we're thinking about doing something, when we do it with intention. Horses also have a motor cortex and a voluntary motor cortex. It's kind of under their ears, if we were to go down to where their brain is. It's not as clearly defined or well-organized right to left in a horse's brain the way it is in the human's brain. Most of what we know about neuroscience has come from studying human brains or small mammal brains like mice. There's not a lot of neuroscientific study and evidence from larger animals because it's really hard to get them into a lab and hook them up to machines and electrodes and get them to do stuff, right? It's
really
very expensive.
Difficult, yeah. Really difficult to have a horse in your teeth.
So often when we're talking about parts of the brain or how this works, we're translating what we've learned by studying human neurophysiology to other complex mammals. Because like mice brains, for example, they don't even have the wrinkles, right? Their brains are completely different. But on the primitive level, they share a lot of the same physiology. So I'm going to push those rabbit holes to the side if I can for a minute. And so we can, horses do use the voluntary part of their cortex as well. We used to think, and this is less of a trend, which I love now, we used to think horses didn't really think conscious thoughts or have a sense of self, or they used to not think animals even had emotions, right? That's kind of old paradigm. We've moved away from that mostly, I feel like, in the industry. But they do certainly have the ability to think independent thoughts and make decisions and move in a voluntary way. So we don't often use the voluntary motor cortex to control our body. And when we do, it feels slow and awkward, and because it's just not, it's not something we practice, especially as adults. We do it more when we're kids and when we're learning how to move through the world. So that's really the main difference. You can do a movement like I just did. I shrugged my shoulders with my muscles that lift my shoulders, right? The upper trapezius muscle, the levator scapula muscles. I can send motor output to them from various places in my brain to shrug. The motor output comes from or passes through the cerebellum or comes from the brainstem or various other places if I'm doing it on autopilot or unconsciously. If I were to really plan it and do it with intention and slowly and specifically, the motor output comes from the voluntary motor cortex to do that. That's really the main difference. So in a way, it's very simple. But for me to be able to explain it, there's sort of this complex backstory of brain anatomy that we don't have to go into, I guess. But I feel like that makes it make sense. And then you also have peripheral nervous system motor output that comes from, let's say, the knee-jerk reflex that, I don't know if they do that in at the doctor's office anymore, but where they tap on the tendon right below your patella to make your foot kick. Yeah. That's a test that they do to make sure your nervous system is working. If you don't kick when the doctor does that below your knee, there's usually a problem with your nervous system, right? So the reason that your foot kicks is because when that tendon gets tapped on, it stretches the muscles between your knee and your hip on the front of your thigh, the quadriceps muscles. There's a spinal cord level reflex called the stretch reflex or the myotatic reflex that's triggered when the muscle tissue is stretched. And it causes the muscle to contract. When your quad contracts, your foot kicks, right? So when the tap happens, there's sensory input. My muscle's getting stretched. It goes up to the spinal cord segment that controls the quadricep muscle. It synapses immediately through an interneuron right back on the motor neuron that comes out and causes the quadricep muscle to contract. And then you and your brain find out about the same time that it worked when you see your foot kick because you can't really feel it. Right. And you go, oh, look, my foot kicked. That's weird. I didn't do that on purpose. Because you didn't. It wasn't motor output coming from the voluntary motor cortex. It wasn't even coming from your brainstem or through the cerebellum or anywhere else. It was coming directly from that spinal cord segment where that reflex arc is. So those are really the three, if we're talking kind of in the simplified version, the three kinds of motor output that are traveling around in your body to create movement. Most of the time we function on autopilot. Depending on what happens to us, we respond with a reflex. Like if you step on a sharp rock, for example, that triggers a bunch of reflexes so that you can get off the rock as quickly as possible, shift your weight to the other side. There's a whole complex series of like how your muscles have to then contract on the opposite side. Your extensors contract on one side, your flexors contract on the other side, and that's how you can hop to your other leg really quickly. If we had to think about doing that, we wouldn't do it fast enough to save ourselves from a stone bruise or from an injury. Or when the tiger jumps out from behind the bush and tries to eat us for dinner, you can't use your voluntary motor cortex to think your way out of that fast enough to survive. That's why we operate on autopilot most of the time. It's much faster, much more efficient.
And now you really beautifully explained the difference in between a voluntary response and a reflex. But when I was reading up here about Hanna Somatics and doing a little bit of homework, I also saw that This general stretching is not so popular in this kind of work. And that is, of course, something that we learn a lot as physiotherapists or as osteotherapists. There's a lot of stretching. So why is that not included into HANA somatic work when it's also a part of body work? I mean, HANA, if we are putting HANA somatics into this overall building of body work,
Well, I would put HANA somatics in the building next to the body work building because it's not really body work. We actively avoid stretching when we're doing HANA somatics. Stretching is something that happens to your body, not something that comes from within your nervous system, right? With your brain, you can't lengthen a muscle. With your nervous system, you cannot tell that muscle to lengthen. The only way you can stretch a muscle is to apply mechanical forces, right? You can do that to yourself, right? If you put your foot up on a table or a bar or a fence and you lean forward, you can use leverage and gravity to apply a mechanical force to your muscles, to your fascia, to your other tissues, right? But you can't just stand there and think your way into a stretch. It's not a somatic activity, right? It's something that comes from the outside. Typically, a body worker would do that to you or to the horse if we pull on the body, right? So that's the philosophical reason why we don't stretch. But there is a physiological reason why we avoid stretching in HANA somatics too. And I actually already mentioned it, and it is that stretch reflex, the involuntary spinal cord level automatic reflex, that when a muscle is stretched, it almost always, it almost always triggers the stretch reflex, which causes the muscle to shorten again to its pre-stretch length. This is basic muscle physiology that we have known about for decades. And if you ask them, body workers, physiotherapists, vets, chiropractors, most of the practitioners who stretch themselves or stretch horses and recommend it, they've heard of the stretch reflex. So they know about it, but they maybe haven't thought very much about it, or they haven't. I guess I don't know. I'm not one of those people who does stretches. I wasn't a body worker before I came across equine HANA somatics and learned how to do that with my horses and then tried it with myself because it worked so great for the horses, and then found out that it was the answer to my chronic back pain and to my postural problems. Then I figured out it was also the answer to all of my riding students' problems that made them, you know, made me as a riding instructor have to say all the same things that all riding instructors say, right? Sit up, look where you're going, pull your shoulders back, lengthen your leg, open your hips. All of the things, right? But so stretching causes a recontraction of the muscle. My goal, our goal with HANA somatics is to help the individual achieve a longer resting length of their muscles. So those two things don't go very well together. And in fact, when you're doing the HANA somatics or equine HANA somatics exercises, if you do them as a stretch, which some people who misunderstand what we're doing or who just watch us and then go try it with their horse, they will do what looks like the same exercises we might do with the horse, but instead of asking the horse to move their own leg, they'll pull the horse's leg forward. And then they trigger the stretch reflex. And it still can feel really nice, and it can actually give the horse a temporary lengthening and temporary relief from any tension they might have had in those tissues. But typically, because the stretch reflex gets triggered, it automatically brings the muscles back to their pre-stretch length. That's the resting muscle tone.
And that makes a lot of sense for me, because also in osteopathy, we are learning a technique where we are doing exactly the opposite. So if we want to shorten a muscle, we are stretching it a little bit and then working with the stretch reflex and trying to make it contract back, and the opposite way around. So if we want a muscle to get longer, we are manually contracting it a little bit and then allow it to relax again. And that works for me, or from my observation, much better than pulling on a leg. And in general, I don't like leverages, and I don't like it if the horse can't really voluntarily.
It's also risky.
Yeah.
You can injure yourself or injure a horse by stretching them. It's
forceful.
Very, it's much less likely that you'll injure a horse by asking them to move their own body, or by asking a muscle to shorten the way you were just describing, which is actually one of the techniques that we teach in equine hand somatics.
Yes. Yeah.
It's called kinetic mirroring in hand somatics. It's actually a technique that was popularized first by Moshe Feldenkrais, and that they use in Feldenkrais methods of somatic education and their bodywork approach. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing when you do it manually, we're bringing the origin and the insertion of a muscle closer together, which causes the fibers to shorten, which is just like doing a contraction, right? So the horse or the person isn't doing it with motor output. We're doing it manually with our hands. But when that gets shorter, the Golgi tendon organs in the tendons on either end of that muscle get triggered. And their job, it's another spinal cord level reflex arc, their job is to cause a lengthening of that muscle so that we assume it doesn't get damaged. That's also maybe why the stretch reflex is embedded in us, is that when muscles and tissues are stretched, we need to protect ourselves from them getting torn.
Yeah.
That hasn't really been proved. That was a theory. And it turns out it's much more complicated than that. But that works really, really well as a gentle manual technique to cause a tight muscle to release or lengthen a little bit. But it's a spinal cord level reflex, which means it typically gives you a temporary result because the resting muscle tone, so your default length of muscles, is actually controlled by your brainstem. So there's motor output that comes from the brainstem that keeps your muscles at your normal length, wherever you're at right now. You're in your default posture, right? So for a lot of us who spend too much time on the computer doing awesome Zoom conversations, we tend to curl forward, right? So the muscles on the front of our body become shorter and shorter as we adapt to our new Zoom lifestyle.
Posture.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what defines your posture. So we talk so much about posture. Good posture, bad posture, how do we control posture, influence posture. In hand somatics, we really use posture as an assessment tool. Because when I look at your posture, I can see what your muscles are doing, right? I can see which muscles are contracting and pulling you forward into what we call the red light posture or the red light reflex. If the muscles on the back of your body are more contracted, you'll go into the opposite posture. We'll have a nice open chest, a hollow back. Your arms and legs are usually more extended. That's called the green light reflex or the green light posture. It's more of the startle, ready for action, excited. You can picture a horse doing that when they get spooked, right?
Yeah.
Those postures, it's not like the posture itself that we're looking at or that we're trying to change, but the posture tells us where the muscles are contracting. And if it's happening all the time, then we know, oh, that's the default setting for that horse right now. If they're doing it all the time, it's the brainstem that's maintaining that. They've learned to do that because they spooked enough times to habituate to that. And now they have motor sensory amnesia. They don't know that they're in the spook posture all the time. That's just the most comfortable place to go back to because that's what they do. So we look for that to find out which muscles are the most contracted. And is it something they're doing in the moment because there's something scary, right? Are they actually spooking or are they doing it as a habit? Because if they're actually spooking, it's a nervous system state. It's in response to the environment. But if it's a habit, it's in response to the past. It's something they learned and they're still responding to it, but they don't know they're doing it. So that's what they don't need to do anymore. That's what we can help them stop doing by doing the voluntary pendiculation exercises that allow their nervous system to recognize the old pattern as no longer useful and bring them back to neutral, which is much more efficient.
Nice. Yeah.
And stretching gets in the way of that process. Yeah. So that's why we avoid it.
Mm-hmm. So now I have lost my red thread here because there was so much in your answer there that I would have 100 hooks where I could go in here. Let's talk a little bit about posture. You beautifully described how you can read from posture which muscles are activated or which patterns are activated. When we're talking about posture, we always also need to talk about where do we have behavioral patterns or learned patterns, and where is it a structural issue? Where is it, has it become already a structural issue that we need to talk about pathology, and how is that coming into the game?
Yes, we can talk about this.
Yes.
Well, how about I tell you my definition of posture to start with?
Let's start with that. Great.
And now I wish it's kind of a long definition the way I've like crafted it, and I don't have it in front of me. So I'm just going to go off the cuff here. But basically, posture it's not a shape or a body position or a structure. It is an ongoing adaptive process of the nervous system, right? That organizes the body in the best way it can, moment to moment, to respond to what's going on within the existing limitations that it has, right? And the main limitation that we recognize in hand somatics and that I see, and maybe someday someone will convince me there's something else that is a bigger limitation, but it's the set level of resting muscle tone, which we started to touch on a couple minutes ago. So your default muscle length all over your body defines where you go when you're not doing something else, right? Your default setting. When you relax, you go into your default or your habitual posture, right? And what that looks like is defined by how long or short each of your muscles are, and then how they are contributing to the overall tensegrity of your body, right? So if the muscles on the front are shorter, you'll curl forward. If the muscles on the back are shorter, you'll be pulled backward. If the muscles on one side are shorter as their default setting, you'll have asymmetry. So posture is in the moment a presentation of which muscles are contracting. It doesn't tell us why. It doesn't tell us how long the horse has been doing it, but it shows us what's happening right now, right? But it's also a response to the environment, right? So it also is a reflection of nervous system state, right? So if you're on alert, if you're in fight or flight, if you're excited, you go into that position because you're responding to your environment. So when we're assessing posture, we have to consider that there might be something triggering what we're seeing, and we have to watch the horse or the person move around long enough to see, is that just a momentary thing, or is that their default pattern they keep coming back to? And I think about so many horses that I watch either under saddle or when they're being lunged or worked in groundwork. The person is trying to teach the horse to relax and drop their head. And you can ask a horse to do that, and they can do it, just like you and I can sit up straight if I tell us to. We can perform great posture when we think about it. You can teach a horse who's got a chronically tight back to lift it and lengthen and drop their head and neck. But as soon as they stop doing that on purpose using voluntary motor output, they will default back to their habitual posture, the brainstem level motor output that was there all the time, that they can override or they can inhibit in the moment, just like you and I can sit up straight even if our back is sore, or even if our chest is shortened. We can do it, but that only lasts as long as you actively think about doing it. And I think about this as a riding instructor a lot, because I can tell a rider what to do with their body to sit correctly on a horse, but most of the time they can only do it for maybe 90 seconds after I tell them what to do. And then they get distracted, or the horse stumbles or something, and they go back to their default to their habitual posture because they didn't actually change it or learn anything. They were just in the moment overriding it. And I call that performance posture. It's not really your posture, right? It's a performance of good posture that we can almost all of us can do unless we have a severe conformational deformity or a major accumulation of scar tissue or ossification around joint, or if we've been in a major traumatic injury that we could not recover from and that has left residual issues in our body. Most people, like most horses, can perform good posture briefly.
Briefly, exactly, briefly.
Right. And that's what most people, I think, are training for. They're trying to strengthen a horse or a person's ability to maintain good posture longer and longer. Because it is helpful, right? Because it does put you in structural alignment. It does reduce wear and tear on a lot of places that we're getting overused by a poor postural organization, for example. But I'm really interested in long-term effects. And how can I help a horse or a person be better and stay better and keep getting better on their own? And the place where I feel most able to do that is by helping them change their habitual posture, where they spend the rest of their time, not just by getting them to be better and better at performing good posture layered over the top of their not so great posture that is actually where they live.
Yeah, I'm always interested. I'm always saying I'm not so interested in, especially when I'm assessing horses. I'm not so interested in seeing what the human can make them do, but how the horse is choosing to use its own body or to present itself. Does it want to have the head high or low? Does it want to have the head in the middle or more on the left side or on the right side? And what can we learn about this movement pattern giving us information about also what pathologies there might be, what postural issues there might be, and where we can start to, where we can enter the process,
exactly,
to give better access.
And I would actually go even dial it back even more. And I want to change one of the words that you used, and maybe it's a language translation difference, or maybe it's a way you're thinking about it difference. I don't know. We'll find out. But that when you're assessing a horse, I like that you don't want to see how the owner can influence them, right? Yeah. And I do the same thing. When I'm assessing a horse, the last thing I want is for someone to square the horse up.
Yeah.
Because that's just like me sitting up straight. I'm performing good posture. Like, how is that useful? I don't want to see that. I want to see the habits, right? I want to see where that horse really is at. But you said, how is the horse choosing to organize themselves versus the human? And that the horse isn't actually choosing their posture. Posture is not a choice. It is just where they're at. It's involuntary. And that's the word change that I think is important to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because if you track back what, like the neurophysiology, right, the motor output associated with making a choice and doing a movement on purpose, that's one type of motor output. But if we recognize that it's the default habitual posture that's causing the horse to do what most people would call a choice, then we have an incorrect picture of what's happening inside the nervous system. And I think that's really important because if we can see where the motor output is coming from, then we know how to influence it. But if it's all lumped together, How do we influence it? It's much harder to influence. And then you have hit and miss kind of results. If you don't know if you're influencing voluntary motor output or spinal cord level reflexive motor output or habitual motor output that has been learned and is happening underneath all the other kinds that we're seeing. So most of the time, the horse is not choosing their posture. They're not choosing to keep their head up. It's just going up there because their back muscles are habitually tight. And when the back muscles contract, it puts leverage on the horse's nuchal ligament and skeleton, and it lifts the head up. So the horse didn't choose to put their head up. They didn't choose to contract their back. It's just happening because that's their default pattern. So if we can help the horse reset their back muscles to a more normal, neutral, resting length, which would be relaxed, the head will stop popping up immediately. And we can help horses change that postural presentation or that habit in seconds if you get them to do the right somatic movement. And it truly is intrinsic. It's truly coming from the voluntary motor cortex. They're doing a voluntary pendiculation. They can change their default levels of habitual tension in real time during the movement. So that, along with that we don't recommend stretching, I think are the two things that make this work, Hannah Somatics, really hard for people to wrap their head around, because that is very different from what we've been taught and from what almost everyone else is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's right. It's my, most of the time, it's always about what we as a human can make a horse do. And not so much about giving the horse voluntary access to its body. And I really like your way of thinking about it. And when I am thinking about that, I always have to also think about pathology, maybe because that is a big part of my work. And when I'm thinking about a horse that is taking up the head, then I have these two pictures in my mind. And the one picture is what you have just been describing about the two short back muscles, especially if we have ill-fitting saddles or a horse that isn't fit for the job for whatever reason. but of course, also front leg pathology would be a reason for it, right? Offloading of the front legs and then just taking weight off so that something else is helping to make the body move forward. And that is becoming a big part of my work, where I sometimes think it's really difficult to decide how much do I want to interfere with this pattern, because obviously the horse has been exploring it or habituating to it, because there's another issue underneath, and it's a protection mechanism from a specific pain area. But on the other hand, it might create more pain on other spots. You know what I mean?
So what you're describing, if I'm going to use big words, is compensation patterns or compensatory muscle contractions or compensatory posture.
Yes.
Right? Those are three ways people describe basically the same thing, right? And I think for most of us, most of the time, compensations or compensation patterns or compensatory posture are sort of dirty words. They're negative. they're presented in a negative light, right? But compensating is actually positive. It's very useful to an animal. It's part of being adaptive, being adaptable, and it's an adaptive response to the environment, to pain if you're injured or to stepping on a sharp rock or something, right? It's very important that we can compensate for those things in the moment and when it's useful, right? The problem is that my observation is that most of the compensations that I see are not useful anymore. They're not compensating for something that's happening right now. I mean, maybe that horse has a tight-fitting saddle right now, you know, our imaginary horse that we've been assessing in our conversation, right?
That we created here, yeah.
But it's entirely possible, and I find really, really common, that horse has a habituated and unconsciously learned and persistent compensation pattern of those shortened, chronically tight back muscles that caused the back to hollow away from the tight saddle they wore 10 years ago. That's when they were compensating usefully, right? To get their back away from the pinch of the saddle. But by repeating it, it habituates. There's no way around that. Repetition causes habituation. So then they learned that they just keep their back contracted. And this is a function of the efficiency of the nervous system. Is anything that you repeat, it'll put on autopilot so that it can save attention for dealing with the tiger that's actually before you, right? So maybe the horse is currently experiencing back pain because they actually are ridden with a tight saddle today. But maybe they've been carrying their back hollow for 10 years because 10 years ago somebody rode them with a tight saddle long enough that they habituated to the compensation that made their life okay at that time. Because once you habituate to a compensatory muscle contraction, it can literally stay there for years, for decades even. Under the radar, unconscious, motor output coming from the brainstem 24/7, keeping that back hollow. That's what I see happening to most horses. And when you look at the horse, whether you have access to the rider and the saddle to make an analysis or not, I find you can't really tell, at least I, from the outside, I cannot tell with any predictable amount of accuracy if that horse is compensating for something in their life now, or if this is a learned maladaptive compensation pattern that they are still doing, but the issue, the injury, the tight saddle, the fill in the blank, isn't in their life anymore, but they're still compensating for it unconsciously. I can't tell. I can't tell by palpating because the muscles are tight. It feels like what it feels like, right? I can't really tell by watching because the horse is just doing it. I can't really tell by asking the person, the human, the rider, whoever, the horse's guardian, because most of them don't know the horse's whole history. And if you start explaining this stuff to them, they start to feel worried that they're causing it and then defensive, and it's hard to get accurate information sometimes without making the owner feel bad, which is not what we're trying to do, right? We're just trying to help the horse and find out what's going on. But so if the horse is currently experiencing back pain because they don't have good saddle fit, they need their saddle fit addressed. You got to talk to the owner. Something has to change, right? But if it's a compensation pattern that's become maladaptive
and chronic,
changing the saddle won't help, right? And we see this. Training won't help, you know, getting them to perform, to lift their back, doing those tummy tuck reflex exercises is not going to help that horse because they can do it in the moment, but it doesn't change that brainstem motor output that they don't even know they're producing, right? But if you can get them to change the brainstem motor output, they can stop causing themselves to have a sway back immediately once you change it, because the muscles respond to whatever motor output they're currently receiving. So we know even if a pattern has been there for 10 years, it's actually happening right now if we can see it. And that's why we can change it right now. If you can see it, if you can get the horse to change their motor output, their muscle tension will change in that moment. And if you can get it to change their default motor output, their resting level of tension, it'll change and it'll stay that way. Not just for 2 hours, not just till next week. It's a semi-permanent change. So until the next trauma, or if they are indeed still being ridden by that tight saddle, tomorrow when that tight saddle goes on, they'll start relearning how to do the compensation that they need. And this is my long-winded answer to your question, is that I will not presume to know which compensation patterns a horse needs or doesn't need right now. But I know that if I help them change a compensation that they still need because they're still being ridden in a tight saddle, or because they have a bruise on one of their feet, or because something else, and that they live on a slope and they're always standing on the slope and they have to compensate to balance if that's what their paddock is like, right? They will simply relearn the compensation that they need. And that's the best way I can help these horses.
Yeah.
Is I can free them from the compensation patterns they don't need anymore. If they still need some, they'll just do them again.
Relearn it.
But because I'm not doing it to them, I'm not going to hurt them, right? I'm not changing their body. I'm not addressing their tissues. That's an outcome of them changing their motor output. And then they do rest.
Nice. That's a really nice way of putting it. I like that. I like that very much. Yeah.
It really relieves the pressure too, right? So one of the really important things we have to talk about in the body world is exactly this, right? How do we know whether we should or shouldn't take that compensation away from that horse, right? My answer is you never know. Please don't take that compensation away from that horse, right? Instead, let's set it up so the horse can decide. right? It's not the conscious part of the horse's brain, but we're going to let the horse's nervous system decide what they need and what they can let go of. And my experience is, I want to say 80 to 90% mm-hmm. of the postural issues, the chronic tension, and the associated pathology that hasn't become so bad that it can't be reversed, mm-hmm. simply melt away when you help the horses let go of their chronic maladaptive, compensatory, habitual muscle tension. Which an easier way to say that is just resting muscle tone, right? When we help them normalize their resting muscle tone, most of the problems melt away. And that includes behavioral, not just soundness issues, not just performance issues, behavioral and training issues. In my experience, at least 80% of them are related to a difficulty in their body that is related to habitual chronic tension.
No, relaxation
always
helps.
And the pain and other things.
Yeah, relaxation always helps. and I really like how you were putting that and also the context you're building up around it. Because I am more and more, and I don't know if that is a thing in the US, but in Europe, or especially in Germany, we have a huge problem with neck malformations and with horses that have neurological issues, whatever. I mean, we have a million of diseases that might be underlying that, and they are so often underdiagnosed, and then you're coming there as a riding teacher or as a body worker, and the owner is pretty desperate, and the pony is pretty desperate, and Errol, then I am pretty desperate, because then we are all desperate together. And then we are often coming into this area where it's really difficult to decide what can we do, where is it a good idea to interfere here and give the body new ideas, and where should we raise our stay in areas where we say, okay, don't touch it. It's a functioning system as it is. Mm-hmm. We don't try. Obviously, the horse has well organized. Keep it as it is. Don't get this, you know, out of the balance it has created for itself for survival. Won't get better.
Even for those horses, I think they could benefit from this work. Mm. Because even the ones who've come up with functional compensations that allow them to move through life, they're still carrying tension that they don't need to be doing. And that the reason that that's a problem is, number one, tension anywhere is creating wear and tear, right? It's creating mm-hmm. friction. So it's going to, if they're carrying tension they don't need, it's going to lead to a problem, to a pathology, mm-hmm. To an injury, to chronic pain. Mm-hmm. The other is that it requires energy to maintain muscle contractions. So even for a horse who looks straight, doesn't have pain, compensates just fine, is happy in their job, can jump the jumps or whatever, you know, they are less able to do their job and to enjoy their life outside their job if they're burning energy to be mm-hmm. okay, right? So there's this spectrum of how we can help horses that I feel like we're all operating in. And unfortunately, where we're at right now, I feel like, is we're at the bottom end of the spectrum where not just for equine hand somatic educators, but for any of us who are trying to help horses, we are statistically, I think it's 89% of horses are lame.
Oh, that's even worse than
that's all of them.
I have heard. Yeah.
That's all of them. Okay. Yeah. So we are at the point where we are helping horses get out of pain and just be able to function and not be put down, not be euthanized, or not be dangerous. Right. Same thing with riders. The statistic for riders and trainers and horse professionals and just adult humans in general is almost the same. It's something like 80% of adults over the age of 25, not just equestrians, but all humans in Western countries have chronic back pain. There's something wrong with those numbers, right? I think maybe Hannah Somatics could be a huge part of the solution well outside the horse industry for this issue. But we're working with just getting people and horses out of pain and back in their body to where they can just be okay, right? That's the bottom end of the spectrum. The middle part of the spectrum is like improving body awareness and connection and self-awareness and just general cognitive and nervous system function for these horses who have been in sensory deprivation or who have been in pain for so long that they stopped engaging with their environment and now their neurons have atrophied, right? So we can bring them back online to where they can now become the horse they're supposed to be on the inside, just like with our people, our humans. We can reconnect with ourselves and reconnect the body and the mind into the soma that we actually are and don't know how good it can be and how easy and effortless just being in a body can be. That's an awesome middle place that we get to work in sometimes, but that's we're lucky if we have clients who are there, right? Most of our clients are unfortunately haven't gotten that comfortable yet. And then there's this other place where I see this work going, and that's the performance enhancement, which is already going to be happening in the other phases. But beyond performance enhancement to self-actualization, to not just being out of pain, to not just being able to win races or, you know, jump higher or not knock down poles or not drag your feet, but to be the best version of yourself or be that horse, let that horse be the best, happiest, most free, soundest version of themselves that they could be. And we do sometimes get to work with horses like that, that like they're totally sound. They're winning. They're happy. They have no training issues. And we do equine hanasomatics with them and they get even better.
Better.
Even happier. Even smarter. They start to jump higher. Mm-hmm. They start to just do things that they maybe did when they were young, but they're doing less of. Mm. They start doing those things again. Mm-hmm. And what Thomas Hanna called hanasomatics for humans from the very beginning was that it's the solution to the myth of aging. Because if we were to make a list of the pathologies, the diseases, the symptoms, the chronic pains, most of those would fall under the category of aging, right? Mm-hmm. But the theory here, the philosophy behind this is that they're not actually related to aging. We don't need to decline and become, you know, like crunched up and in pain and dysfunctional as we age. We can keep getting better right up until the end physiologically. There's just something that is getting in our way and causing us and blocking us from being able to access our own potential to just be comfortable and have effortless movement and be out of pain and enjoy being in our body and have brains that work. I mean, is that too much to ask?
No, I don't think so. It's, you know, I see that in my father-in-law. He's 86. Yeah, 86 he is now. He's turning 87 soon and climbing up a mountain each day. And I think that's so unbelievable impressive. Sharp in his mind, winning all the quiz games that we are playing in the family. It's really impressive. I really like that. I hope I can get a little bit of that when I'm...
But what if that is, what if that's normal, right? What if that's the normal progression of aging instead of the rare example of somebody who does it well? And I think that is the premise that Thomas Hanna was talking about. Eleanor Criswell, always, she was just so motivated by the actualization of human potential and just easing suffering for humans and animals with this work, because that's ultimately what we're doing. We can talk about posture and how it can influence, you know, hoof shape and how it, you know, how it helps our bodies feel better when we're doing this work. But the potential for improvement and improvement in just well-being is huge here. And it's all related, just like the mind and the body are connected. All of the dis-ease is related to what's blocking us from ease.
Yeah. So if I'm trying to find back to my red thread and lead us here a little bit towards wrapping it up, what do you think when we are looking at the road ahead, what needs to change in how trainers and therapists are educated? What would be your wish
I would love for, and I'll just speak about horses because it's too easy to get lost in the bigger world, but for horses and riders and people who love them and work with them and the professionals in our industry, to be able to see horses the way I was talking about before, so that we can differentiate between what is like, what are we looking at? What is a nervous system response to the present? What is a habitual pattern? And what is actual dysfunction? Because if we can, I think I'm going to actually, I mean, I know this is strong to say, but I think it's actually impossible to assess a horse's ability or strength or symmetry if we don't first free them from their habitual tension. Right? Because habitual tension on the left side of your body creates a left bend, which creates a preference for a left lead, which creates fill in the blank, right? Oh, so many things. But it also makes the right side present as weak. In our horse that we're talking about, our imaginary horse with the tight back and the high head who wore a tight saddle 10 years ago, that horse will have, most people would assess that horse as having a weak core. And that horse would be getting pole work and tummy tucks and hill work and all kinds of stuff to try to strengthen that horse's core so that they can lift themselves out of that hollow backed posture. But if I could get the professionals in charge or the owners who are in charge of what that horse does with their life and their fitness and rehab programs to see that the horses, they may not have a weak core, right? I'm not saying that there aren't horses who have weak abdominal muscles and who need strength training, right? But if their back is chronically contracted, which is forcing them into an extended posture, you can't measure strength of the abdominal muscles because they're mechanically inhibited. The horse can't use them, or they can't use them very well, or they can't use them without a whole bunch of extra effort to overcome the hollow back and the tight back muscles. So there's no way to measure. So why give that horse strength training for something that you don't even know is weak, right? I would love for that horse to first be freed from the back tension. Let them walk around for a couple hours. Then assess their core strength. Then create a training program for them. Then fit them for a saddle because their back shape will change when it's not contracted anymore too, right? All of the things that we're doing, I feel like if we could do this first, it would make everything else we're doing easier, and we'd be able to assess and help horses from a much more accurate place.
Nice. Let's take that as a good closing thought that we can send out to the world. And maybe some trainers and therapists that can take that into their tool case for the future. Alyssa, thank you very much for tonight. Thank you very much for this podcast. I am very much looking forward to listen to your lecture during the summit in March. But I know also that you are offering an online program. Maybe you would like to add a few words to your program. Where can people find you if they want to work with you?
Yeah. So I... You know, I didn't even introduce myself at the beginning here. I'm realizing now. But so in addition to being an equine Hannah somatics educator and working with clients, which I used to do full time, I don't do that very much anymore because I'm so busy now as the director of the equine Hannah somatics professional training program. So my time mostly now is dedicated to training up equine Hannah somatics educators, practitioners who can take this knowledge out into the world, to the horses and to the people who work with them. And that program, it's offered completely online now in 2020. Like everyone, we switched from going teaching in person to teaching online. And this program translates very, very well to online learning, which not a lot of hands-on with horses type work do, because the technique and the quality of touch and those kind of things are so, so essential to the safety and the efficacy of most approaches. But this one, because we're asking the horse to do their own movements, is so gentle and so safe and is so based and grounded in these natural nervous system reflexes and processes that it's really effective teaching it online. So we have a 2-year online program for professionals who are interested in pursuing certification in this work and learning the neuroscience behind it and how we address various postural presentations and the chronic habitual muscle contractions that are generally behind them with equine hand somatics. So that program, we're taking applications for it right now. So through February 14th, we take in applications, and then the first module of the program begins in the fall. And then there's 3 modules total once nice. Each year once you begin the program. So that information is all available on the Equine Hand Somatics website, which is equinehandsomatics.org, which is a mouthful. So maybe you can add that to the show notes or something.
Add that to the show notes so everybody who's interested can have a look at that and get their application out for this exciting education.
Thank you. There's one more thing I'd like to share about that, and that's that the prerequisite to our professional training program is our introductory course, which is designed for horse owners and equine professionals, trainers who are interested in doing this work with their own horse, but maybe don't get what it is yet or haven't tried it or aren't sure if they want to pursue the professional track. And Eleanor Criswell, who created Equine Hand Somatics, and she and I made this introductory course with the goal that someday we can get every horse to experience equine hand somatics. And I think the only way something like that is possible is if we empower the people in the horse's life to know the basics and to be able to do this work with their own horse. So that's what we designed the intro course for. It'll teach anybody with any level of experience, as long as they can be safe with horses, to do a basic introductory assessment and then equine hand somatic session that they can modify to be appropriate for their horse. And that's also available on the website. But it's not just for professionals. This is something that we want to get into the hands of every horse person so that every horse can be freed from their elevated habitual tension.
And that is so lovely. And I think each horse or each horse owner, not only the horse, but also the horse owner is profiting from it. Having a more relaxed pony, relaxation always helps. It's a good thing to do. Get involved.
It does. Yes.
So thank you for tonight. We will link the links in the show notes and send them out on our newsletter. And then I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. And I don't want to keep you up, but I could do this all night. This was fun.
Yeah, we continue later. Now.
To be continued.
Yeah, to be continued. Bye.
Bye.